should just adjust.
I think these other pins are better.
What?
Yeah, I think these are better pins.
Oh, okay. Okay, I talked about some of this last year, here actually, but we have done quite a bit more in this year. So, so last year I talked somewhere with Junli, and this year we talked about somewhere with Fu.
Try a green pen, maybe.
Green pen? You have to use the broad part. Okay, so both of them are talking about trying to talk with torsion. Complex manifold with torsion. So, both of them are modeled after the paper by Andy Stromiger. Oops. Okay, good. So basically, the complexification goes in this way. So this is a four dimension. This is a four-dimensional Minkowski space-time or other measurable symmetric space-time. This is an internal space, six-dimensional. So, but now we put a twisting factor there, that this will be the dilaton. So we want a, well, after you impose the symmetry.
Sorry. I have to have this.
Yeah.
We'll get it.
we find a complex structure eventually. You want a spinor and set all the supersymmetric conditions and put down a dy there. Then we found the following relevant quantity. A Hermitian form. First of all, there exists a complex structure and there exists a Hermitian form. On this internal space, and there exists a holomorphic free form.
So, why is the internal space there?
Yeah, why is internal space? And this is for why is the Minkowski space time? This is internal space. X is the internal space.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay.
Because you have dilaton as a function of the y. Are you sure? Why? I mean, the way you're writing is.
Well, I think that's how it comes out.
You know,
you depends on
x. Yeah.
Oh,
c right.
Depends on x.
Right.
Yeah. Omega is a holomorphic free form. Non-red is a holomorphic free form. So this on the internal space now, all of this. So on the six-dimensional manifold. So this becomes a complex manifold with an integrable, almost complex structure, and a holomorphic, non-random holomorphic free form. So the manifold has first trend cast equals 0, no matter what.
So
what?
Complex manifold will vanish in first trend cast.
Right. It still needs that. And more than that, there exists a holomorphic free form.
But the metric is not Kähler.
The metric is not Kähler.
Both Hermitian.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So we just tell you this. How do we do it? Oh, okay.
Well, we have two different styles. Both work.
Okay, sure. Okay, so anyway, what we end up is the following four equations. There's a bundle, holomorphic. first time. So, holomorphic vector bundle. Where the first train class of E is equal to 0, and the second train class of E is equal to second train class of manifold. And since the manifold is no more, from now on, M is the internal space. And since the manifold is not a scalar, so we have to be careful about what this means. What this means is that as a form, they are equal plus dd bar or something. So it's more refined. Well, in the scalar case, this is automatic because that's called dd bar lemma. Any two cohomology class which is pp type has to be equal dd bar something. But in a non-scalar complex manifold, this may not be true. So this has to be careful. So under this condition, the four equations we want to solve has the following property. The curvature of the bundle, we need a Hermitian connection, wedge with omega square. Omega is the Hermitian form that we discussed earlier. And the curvature is the C is 2 0 part is equal to 0. And dd part omega is equal to some constant times the second term form Fe wedge Fe minus trace of R wedge R. So these are the second term form of E. These are second term form of the manifold. And so you ask specifically what this form is. It should be omega. And fourth equation is d minus d bar log capital omega. So that's the equation, actually it's minus here. So four equations coming from supersymmetric consideration exist in a spin-off. And these are the four equations we need to solve in order for the model to have supersymmetry. So the question is how to construct such a thing. So first observation is that this last equation actually can be written as this equation, by the way, determined only when dimension is equal to 3. And otherwise it's over-determined system. So this equation turns out to be equivalent to this equation, which makes important point here. Namely, this being a non-zero function, so what it says is that there exists a Hermitian metric whose square is closed.
Omega is non-singular?
It's non-singular.
Why? Oh, that's another
That's assumption. Capital omega is assumed to be non-zero.
No, small omega.
Small, no, it's Hermitian form, it's non-zero.
Oh, that is the Hermitian form.
Yeah,
right.
That's Hermitian form. Small omega is Hermitian form.
So that last condition plus one of the conditions is equivalent to which others?
There are four equations. These are Hermitian Young-Mills, and this is the anomaly, and this equation is the supersymmetric condition part. This equation is equivalent to this. They are equivalent. That's an important observation. They are equivalent. So what I'm trying to say is this. This actually gives you a non-trivial constraint on the manifold. This part is not scalar. Okay, so let me explain to you now.
So this is almost the same as the last condition we wrote down.
This is equivalent.
It's almost the same as omega is close.
Yeah.
But not quite. Yeah,
not quite. It's a shifting factor.
So there's no sense in which that twisting factor is constant.
No, it's not constant.
Except when the
yeah. So this kind of condition, you can always write in this way. This kind of manifold the name. The manifold, this kind of manifold is called balanced manifold. Manifold which emits a Hermitian metric, etc. This is called balanced. Of course, in general, it's n minus 1.
So you're viewing omega tilde, which is the norm of omega, capital omega times small omega, as the
Yeah, right, Okay. So I'm just telling you in general what kind of constraint you expect on the manifold. So in general, you therefore, if you look at object dimension, that means this condition.
Now, the other two equations you had, you think there's omega tilde as well. Three or four equations. The last one is V of omega tilde squared is zero.
Right.
The other ones can be nicely written in terms of omega tilde two.
Unfortunately not. It becomes, the things becomes much more nonlinear. Unfortunately. Otherwise, the problem is much easier to solve. Okay, this is called balanced manifold. Balanced manifold is actually quite nice, in contrary to Cayley manifold. For example, you take a manifold, you can do a birational transform. You blow up, you can, of course, Cayley manifold after blow up is still Cayley, but you blow down also. If you blow down, the manifold need not be Cayley, if it's Cayley. So you collapse something to a subvariety. As we know, in the case of Calabi-Yau, like the quintic, you take a rational curve, the rational curve can break down to a point, and this manifold could be smoothed out to be a nice non-singular complex manifold, but this need not be Cayley anymore. After all, you destroy the H2, eventually could destroy it completely. So manifold under blowing and blowing down, Cayleyan is destroyed, but not balanced. Balanced manifold turns out is invariant under birational transform. So this is one important feature of this. And also, if you take a suitable fibrillation space, say M to some other manifold, under suitable condition, the image is still balanced. The image of balanced manifold under a dominant map is still balanced. And vice versa, if you have a balanced manifold and the fiber is balanced, and under suitable condition on the cohomology of the fiber, the total space is also balanced. So balanced manifold actually are quite nice in many ways. Satisfy quite a lot of good things under construction by surgery and all that. Okay. So in a way, therefore, the last condition indicate that we should be looking at balanced manifold condition. So therefore, we would like to say that if the manifold is balanced, which is a necessary condition for the system to exist. So balance, and depending on Hn minus 2, so H4, so this is of the manifold, which corresponding to this class. So this would be the modulized space for this structure, and also the modulized space is a vector bundle. So which you require to be stable. It makes sense to talk about stability of bundles because of this condition. Okay? Because you can define the degree of the bundle. Degree wedge omega square makes sense. You just integrate that. Nothing to do with holomorph form. It's just this condition.
Just an arbitrary form omega tilde.
Yeah. Any omega tilde n minus 1, you can do it reversely. You can just say you have an n minus 1 positive definite form, which is close. Okay, put it in that way.
Well,
it automatically comes from some metric. They're Poincaré due to each other.
So So it's a 1-1 form.
1-1 form. Yeah, it's the 1-1 form, so that the end minus one power is equal to that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it doesn't have to be a non-trivial element of H4.
We don't know. I don't see it. Doesn't have to be. Doesn't seem to be. Doesn't. Because the. Well, you see, if the manifold has a lot of complex subvariety, then presumably it should be non-zero. But it could happen the manifold has no complex subvariety. Then there's no reason it should be non-trivial. Okay? So that's the point. So, what I believe seems to indicate. That what the modulus should depend on the vector bundle, and the holomorphic free form should be there, and the Kähler modulus depends on this one only. That's the belief at this moment that I have. The modulus of the manifold itself, the complex structure, and this group, and the holomorphic vector bundle. Modular.
So you're saying with those conditions there will be unique solutions, satisfying some topological condition or not?
That's only a belief.
It's only belief. No, that's I just want to know what the belief is.
So, okay.
But there should be some topological condition on the bundle.
Right. Well, the bundle is a C1 equals C0, C2 equals C2. Okay? So, okay.
The condition seems to be close to this Hitchens stable force, because given this form, you can. And n minus one form, you can construct the volume form, right? And therefore, it defines the metric because you can now start taking contrived units and
still. I don't think this relates to Hitchens stuff. The complex structure has to be there first. You can construct a metric from here. Yeah, I mean from but you are
that's
here.
All I'm saying.
Yeah.
By the way, that D of what D dilaton that you had—that's related to the norm of omega.
Yeah. The so dilaton is related to the norm of omega.
So that's a function of the Calabian moduli.
Right.
The Calabian points.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's right. So that dilaton is non-trivial, but it's related to norm of capital omega. So the condition is C1 E equals C1 of the manifold equals 0, and C2 of E is equal to C2 of the manifold in the Lie-Phi sense plus dd bar of something. Okay, these presumably are the only topological conditions for it to be there. Okay, so now I want to provide some evidence and why I'm more confident about this now than much earlier. So first of all, last year when I talked about this, I assumed this is the work that I did with Juni, is assumed E to be tangent bundle plus trivial bundle or plus a several copies of trivial bundle. So it depends you want to do SU4 or SU5. So this would be SU5 or SU3 if you have one copies. Then we deform the bundle, so it's encoded in the cohomology here, and the deformation, you want to deform the complex structure on the bundle, otherwise the solution will be trivial, just a Calabi-Yau connection on here plus some trivial connection. So anyway, the point is that H1 here is a matrix, and there's some element here correspond to H1 of tangent bundle and H1 of cotangent bundle. And what you want is that the element here should be linear independent. That's what we discussed last year. And then we can deform. We use this deformation. And we can deform the bundle structure here so that we can solve the equation, the system of the four equation. Okay? So in that case, the manifold is still Kähler, and Calabi-Yau in fact deforms from there. So, but today I want to talk about a case which is intrinsically non-Kähler. So the whole thing is non-Kähler. And I had, before I found it difficult to construct natural non-Kähler manifold. So we managed to do it. So let me explain to you how this construction goes. Well, as I said, there are many P people involved in the construction of the manifold, but what we are contributing is how to prove the equation exists. Okay, the manifold, the complex manifold itself was known. So we go the simplest example. In the general, this is a more general case, but the simplest example is a K-field surface. The manifold going to be a toroid. So complex one-dimensional toroid over a K-field surface, which is not scalar. But a K-field surface is scalar. So what we have is two light bundles. I'm sure you can. One can generalize it to be a more non-trivial situation, but let's not worry about more general case. Just do this simple case. So to take two complex light bundles and given by two omega. So omega one, omega two are the first train cars of L1, and omega two is the first train cars of L2, and satisfy some surface condition on S. And then we take the circles, two circles over here, and construct the total space. So that would be the toroid bundle over S. And one can construct a complex structure over there.
S is a
K3. You can do a bit of variety here.
What is M?
M is a total space.
Oh, okay.
It's a total space we are interested in. So the whole thing would be here.
Yeah.
So the bundle, we can do more generally, but so you can do a two bed of L1 plus two bed of L2 plus two bed of the tangent bundle of S plus some trivial bundle, and you can then you deform the complex structure over here. Okay. So two bed is all these bundles on S, and then plus some trivial light bundle, and then you deform the total bundle. So you get a complex structure plus vector bundle over it, and we are going to construct the solutions over here. Okay. Now this manifold in general are not scalar.
And there's no reason the first term class is zero, is it?
No, but we can construct a holomorphic form, so first term class is in fact zero.
Sorry, you can?
We can actually construct explicitly holomorphic free form on M. So it's first train class equals zero. So let me just tell you what it is actually. So there will be a theta. So there's theta 1, theta 2. These are the connection form for there. You just put it together. You can have theta. So theta 1, theta 2 are the connection form associated to the light bundle. And then I take a complex form, one form. And so d theta I equal to pi. Pi star omega I. So there's a connection form. Theta is one form. And we do the following thing, the omega would be pi star omega s. There exists a homomorphic two form here, which is theta. So this turns out to be a globally defined form. I guess that's okay, Colin. So we get holomorphic form defined M. Okay, by doing that. And we get Hermitian form, pi star omega s plus so we call this omega. Okay. So we're going to use this omega to help to construct the equations that we want here. Okay. Well, this does not satisfy the equation a priori. So what we do is that we twist the thing. So it turns out we can construct the equation in the following form. So let me write down a special case first. the general case is similar. In the case omega 2 is equal to n times omega 1. But this is not necessary, but this makes the equation look simpler. In the case of the first train car, so the L2 is equal to the integer multiple of the other one. Then we do the following answers. We simply multiply. We do the following thing. We multiply this whole thing by this one, so U. So multiply here by a function, this one, so U, where U is a function defined on S. Okay? Why do we want to do it? It turns out, no matter what kind of U I put down there, the four equations that Schrödinger has, 1, 2, and 4, is automatic if I do this answer. So the only equation I need to help to solve is number 3. So number 3 turns out to be equivalent to the following equation. So let me write it down up here. Laplacian exponential u plus 1 plus n squared divided by 4 divided by norm omega 1 squared exponential minus u minus 8 determinant u I j bar divided by determinant Cij bar. So equals 0. So that's the equation that is equivalent to number 3, equation number 3. So what is this equation? All these things are defined in R3, I mean in S, in the KP surface. Everything is defined KP surface. So the answer allows you to make the four equations. Now let me erase it. Okay. Let's go to the other page. So, M so first of all, let's say we have the equation. And also, let me write down a topology. The topology is simple. B1, the first Bessel number of the manifold, is equal to the first Bessel number of S plus 1. So, S, I write in this way, of course we know first Bessel number of KP surface equals 0. But the S could be abelian variety, could be taller, in general. And this one, omega 2, is N times omega 1. And B1 of M is equal to B1 of S when omega 2 is not equal to N omega 1. That's not an integral multiple. And B2 of M is equal to B2 of S minus 1 when omega 2 is N omega 1.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused. Isn't M equilibrium threefold?
No.
Oh, I thought you were saying first chain class.
It's first chain class, but it's not Taylor.
Oh, it's not Taylor.
That's whole point.
Right.
So previously we studied the Calabi-Yau case. Everything is in Calabi-Yau. Here we are able to deal with the case when the total space is not Calabi-Yau. Well, it's not Kähler, I mean. What I mean is not Kähler. So B3 of M is equal to 0. So that's the topology of this manifold. Okay. So you can compute the HPQ if one really wants to. And so this give rise to a equation. Let me write down the equation again. Now, I did not write down the equation for when omega 2 is not integral multiple of omega 1. When they are not equal, there's a similar equation you can write down, slightly more complicated. So when they are equal, let me write down the equation again.
Sorry.
So the equation, let me repeat again. So Laplacian is 1 so u plus 1 plus n squared over 4. Omega 1 squared minus u equal to 8 determinant uij bar divided by determinant gij bar. So this defined on the KP surface, or the orbital right here. This equation turns out to be not trivial at all to solve this equation. So I'll remind you how in the case of carving out the equation you want to solve as this type, determinant gij bar plus uij bar is equal to some function times determinant gij bar, where the right hand side is known. So that was the equation we used before for constructing Ricci flat metric. Here the equation has this type. Now, previous case, we want this metric to be a metric, so we want this one to be positive, definite. Now it turns out, this built-in, so it's elliptic, this problem, because elliptic, because you want this guy to be positive, definite. Now, for some reason, in deriving the system, you know, the four equation, supersymmetry does not tell what ellipticity means. Ellipticity is a condition on the linearized equation to be an elliptic equation. So you linearize this equation, you want it to be positive definite, the coefficient. And this does not come from supersymmetric consideration. I don't know why, but we need that. So what the condition is that we need this condition minus f is some function come from here. It's a function, basically this guy, minus u gij bar minus 4 uij bar positive. So this would be the condition that we have imposed. So let me repeat again. This, when we solve the Ricci flat metric equation, we want this to be the metric. So this has to be positive definite. So it turns out the linearized equation to be elliptic is equivalent to this. But in order for this one to be elliptic, we impose this condition. This condition was not seen by physical consideration, but we need it. Otherwise, the whole equation would be a disaster. We could not solve a nonlinear equation without being elliptic, at least with the present technology. So we simply impose it. Now what that means is not quite clear to me, this open condition. It presumably means some curvature to be positive, or something related to that, of the metric that we have. So anyway, the point, what's the point now? We want to solve this equation as a system, as a pair, this equation plus this together. So how do we solve it? Well, the framework is not hard at all, as we always do. If this guy is f, if this guy is equal to 0, we can solve it trivially by just setting u equal to 0 or u equal to some constant. Because u equal to constant, this guy is not there, then Laplace equals 0. The right hand side is also 0, so 0 equals 0. There's nothing to solve. All right, so that's how you start out. So what you do is that you put a parameter here called t, and then you start to do perturbation. So what do? You said that the equation can be solved when t equals 0, and then you said that the t can go from 0 to 1. So when t equals 0, you know how to solve it. And then you move a little bit by perturbation. But you need to know you can keep on moving until you reach 1. So that's called continuity argument. Now the whole point of this argument is to be able to control what happens when t is moving. Namely, you have to estimate. U and so let me tell you roughly how these guys go. So you have to control the estimate of U and the first derivative, U, second derivative, and first derivative.
These are time derivatives, C derivatives, or?
Space derivative.
Space derivative.
Space derivative. Time is kind of octave, so we just put it in. So the point is, we need to control all this. Now, of course, all these things are done only if the equation is nice and only if the geometry are good. So we want to prove that all these guys are bound independent of t. So what you're worrying about when you do this argument, when you move on, when t goes to some point, this derivative may blow up to infinity, and then it has no limit. But on the other hand, if these guys are bound, then you can take limit here, and then you get a nice solution. So that's basically the idea. So the whole argument turns out to be non-trivial and very complicated. In fact, the argument here is more complicated than the original proof of the Calabi conjecture. So let me just show you some of the argument and how this works. So let me.
You mean the proof in this particular case is more involved than the general proof in that case?
Yeah.
Well.
So basically, so we always impose this condition, exponential u minus f exponential minus u. This is electricity condition, actually there's t there. What's the point? We don't assume this to be true at the end. We prove that we can solve the equation past this condition. Okay? So it's not that we make any assumption. We are going to prove that the solution can exist with this condition. But on that hand, on the process, this inequality is always holds. Because we keep on moving, each time when we move, you satisfy this equation, inequality. The tricky point is to give an estimate how big it is, not just bigger than zero, but give a control of how big it is. This means control the ellipticity, what we call. And here, we need to impose a normalization. Normalization is exponential minus u. Over there, equal to a is positive. Well, is of course positive, but actually smaller than something. And this constant can be estimated. This constant can be estimated in terms of supremum, f, and also the curvature. On S. So depending on the curvature of the KV surface and also this F which you can write down, we can find constant C. So whenever U holds in this thing, that means U is large enough, then you can solve the equation. This is normalization in the following sense. This is similar to the thing that I did with Junni. You see, I move from 0 to 1. At 0, there's some ambiguity we can hold. When t equals 0, u equal any constant will solve the equation. When t equals 0, u being any constant could solve that. So what we do is that we start with a constant set by this inequality. That means u has to be reasonably large, a constant at the beginning. So although we don't like to say large radius limit, it appears here. Because you remember the inequality holds exponential u pi star the answer. So u is large, means it's large radius limit. At least in the KV surface direction has to be large. Because I need to make this one to be small. Okay? So this is similar to in the argument that I did with Junni about deformation of Calabi. We also need some reasonable large scale, large radius limit in order to prove existence. But then there's no scale beyond that. So we prove that whenever we start a big constant like this, you can always deform. And so that means despite this four equation is nonlinear, you cannot fix the scale as what some people expect.
You cannot fix what scale?
The radius.
It's arbitrary.
Yeah. Because I thought some people thought that given the complex moduli and all that, you can fix the scale or the Hermitian metric for these four equations. But you cannot fix as we just...
Well, here it's a relative scale, you said, between K3 and T2. But the overall scale is also not fixed here?
Well, the relative scale, yeah, you may say. The as long as the K3 is large, then you can solve the thing. Okay. But anyway, the whole thing is rather nonlinear. It's not coming out by just multiply the metric by constant. You scale the K3, but the fiber is fixed. Okay. So that means that although the four equations are nonlinear, it doesn't really fix the scale. That's one thing one learned. But anyway, now let me show you. You may not want to learn too much detail, but because it's a very complicated argument. So roughly I'll tell you how this works, in case you like to learn something. First of all, we need this elliptic equation, inequality, to control, it's interesting for you to learn how we do this kind of thing. For a large radius, for a large p, we try to estimate this. The gradient of exponential minus u to some pi power norm, we prove some inequality, exponential minus u p minus 1. So we do some integral estimate. And then we found a way to estimate the following quantity, exponential minus infimum u, by taking p equal to infinity, basically, can be estimated in terms of some constant exponential minus u, some L2 norm. So the idea is to get this inequality by integrating this inequality suitably. And then I take p equal to infinity by the gradient of this fellow measures the oscillation of this function. And by measuring it carefully, we can get an estimate on the infimum u. So this tells you the infimum u cannot be can be controlled somewhat in one side. So infimum u cannot be too negative. Once you prove that, this is a little bit somewhat hard work to get. Once you get infimum, you can have it too negative, and you go bad work. And then you have to linearize the equation again, and do another estimate. And then instead of minus u, I take plus u. And then this one becomes p minus some different quantity, similar to that. So you look at u in both negative side and positive side, then you can control the supremum, but you need to control the infimum first. So this gives rise an estimate on supremum u and infimum u, and therefore the L infinity norm of u. U cannot be too big and u cannot be too small, too negative. Now, then there are several tough work to do after this. Namely, you have to do gradient estimate. So what do we do? We have to cook up some interesting function. Take log grad u square plus log v of u. I'll tell you what v of u is later, a little bit later. And I take a p. P is the operator which is obtained by linearizing the original equation. And v of u is this function, exponential 4 supremum u minus 2u plus exponential 2u minus 4 supremum u. This kind of function was cooked up in order to compensate some error that you will see in estimate this fellow. And this turns out to be able to, by looking this operator where p is the linear operator, we can do something called maximum principle and then prove a estimate gradient u. This is too complicated to do the calculation. It takes about 3 pages to do the calculation for here. Anyway, so we do an estimate on the L infinity norm. Here we do an estimate on the L infinity norm of grad U. Okay. So using that. And then it's getting more complicated actually. We do another estimate on second order. So I'll tell you what the second order estimate is. So let me just do it here. So exponential u minus f exponential minus u minus Laplace and u. So I look at this function, and then we look at the linear operator, p operating on it. And the whole point is that you can get a good inequality. These are details has to work out in a very careful way. Turns out there's a good term. The inequality of this type can be found. And so we estimate Laplace and u in that way. And from there we control the second derivative of u. And then we need to control third derivative. Third derivative becomes much more complicated. Let me not write it down. So instead, so let me tell you exactly how this argument goes. So this is basically a lecture on nonlinear equation, how you do this kind of thing. Given a nonlinear equation, u, first derivative, second derivative, okay, the equation of this type. You want to prove existence of such a fellow. Okay? So what do? You linearize the operator, so you differentiate with respect to u, you get some linearized operator, which by I call p. Now, the linear operator in general depends on, because nonlinear depends on u itself, ui itself, uij itself. Okay? So this makes things complicated. But nonetheless, this linear operator can be written as summation aij plus some first order operator and also some C order. So equation of this type. So it's elliptic if Aij is positive definite. Okay? Now being elliptic is not good enough. In all these arguments, you need to, the whole thing is to prove that this matrix, Aij, as a matrix, is bigger than some constant times identity and less than some other quantity, less than that, where alpha and beta can be controlled. So
could it be u dependent constant?
No. That's all for. Yeah, you want alpha and beta to be controlled independent of u. This is called uniform ellipticity. So you solve, so what, how do you do this kind of things? I differentiate this equation locally in any direction and I get an equation of this type equals something. So what this says is that this operator can be looked at as a linear equation. See, you differentiate a nonlinear equation, you pretend it's linear. Where the coefficient says like this. Then there's a standard theory in elliptic equation tells you the solution, if you said like this, is in fact has high order estimate. Okay? That's high order estimate. So that's what?
What does that mean?
The difference is positive definite. Okay? The difference is positive definite. So in this way you can control the high order derivative in this way. So because you see you differentiate this equation by first order differentiation, so this becomes d over dx. Del u, for example, del u is equal to du over dx1. you just defensive, you have to deal with the x1 direction. Then this guy sets an equation of this type. Then there's a theory which tells you d over dx1 in fact is better than the first differentiation. Okay? The estimate. So, this is called bootstrap method. You can keep on differentiating the nonlinear equation many, many times. And each time you prove that the solution is better than what you expect. So you can control the solution up to any order. Up to any order in this way. So, but on the other hand, it's very important, you need the initial data to be good. Now, turns out just this is not good enough. You need a little bit more than Aij, so this is called Holder continuity of Aij. Holder continuity of Aij. So, in fact, it's easier thing is just estimate Aij. Okay? So, let me repeat again now. You need to control the ellipticity, upper bound, lower bound, where alpha, beta are strictly positive. Controlled. And also you need some continuity of Aij. That's why we go to third order. You see, Aij would involve second order of Aij, Uij. You differentiate involve third order. So that's why in all the nonlinear theory, sometimes we go to third order. Once we can control the third order and also ellipticity, then we are in good control. Okay, so third order for this equation turns out to be quite a bit more tricky, which I don't want to write down. But anyway, so this is a procedure. So we control in this way. We control all the differentiation u up to any order after we can do this, because you keep on differentiating this equation, the linear operator is always the same. Okay, the linear operator is always there. We just keep on differentiating it because the whatever left is lower order, which you know already. So it's this way that we prove the existence of this equation. Now, in general, if the answer is not good, you don't expect to be able to solve the equation. So it looks like this in this for this answers we do, the answer is pretty good, and I expect therefore. The whole thing should be nice, but I still need to look for better answers in general. But now you see, let's come back to the question that I was talking. The question is nonlinear because of this fellow. I expect this one to look at as a cohomology class. I need to decompose omega back in order to control the third equation in general. Now this is rather nonlinear because this omega square divided by something in omega. Again, now how to do an effective factorization from this theory, from this class, 2-2 form to the 1-1 form, and then control back to the third equation is quite interesting. I think it's possible, but I don't know exactly how to do it at this moment. I mean, the reason I think it's possible because all this thing turns out to be quite. I mean, I didn't expect that you can solve it actually in this way, but actually we proved that it can be solved, and the procedure is non-trivial. So I believe that this is a good equation. Okay, I'll stop here. In case you're...
Are there any questions?
Yeah. Yeah.
There was some series of papers by the
Beckers, Kishatas, Gupta. Yeah, there's previous people who did it. But they did not solve the equation.
But is it clear how they compare with your ansatz or your
experience? They did not solve this equation. Well, yeah, the manifold is the same manifold, but several groups.
They try to solve the same equations, but what are the assumptions?
They can only solve 1, 2, and 3, 4, but not this third one.
No.
They in fact said that they don't believe it exists.
They were finding explicit
when they say explicit, they solve 1, 2, and 4, but not 3.
Okay.
Have you looked at, so suppose you start, and we've discussed before, suppose you start with S3, the WZW model on S3 yeah. plus D3. Have you looked at trying to deform that and then you get the
Oh, you mean deform the foliation that you used before?
Yeah, just deform S3 cross T3 and see if you can get anything sensible. Get equations that are controllable.
Well, I guess that can be studied. I don't know.
Been studied.
I don't think so, no. Then you have to study non-Kähler complex manifold deforming the foliation. I don't really know. Maybe that's a good point to understand. A lot of these things, at the beginning I thought it doesn't exist, but I'm glad that at least some global case exists. I mean, it's like G2 manifold spin 7. At the beginning it looks like hopeless it exists, but then later one found quite a lot. So I'm not sure.
I have two questions. One is, do you know whether you had a conjecture about the marginalized space of such solutions given
yeah.
by the
yeah, yeah.
choices of H4, complex yeah. structure of M,
right.
and the choice of
right.
E?
Yeah.
In this particular class of examples you study, is that conjecture correct? The conjecture
no.
of these cases?
No, it's not true. I think if I can do it in this class, I probably can do it in general.
Yeah, so it's not
true. Yeah.
Same question is whether in the non-compact cases, if you take local models,
yeah,
presumably much easier taking through that file. Have you studied those?
Not really, but I think, yeah, sure, you can. I mean, a power like S could be non-compact. You can take any ALE and we can
right,
do the
would
same.
Would that be then in that case, can you do more complete analysis?
Oh, maybe then you can solve it explicitly, yeah. And then you can solve it explicitly, yeah. In that case, yeah.
Do you have the explicit method?
It should be possible. It should be possible. The equation, once you rotate the symmetric, depend only on the radius and all that, then I think you can solve it. Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank you again.
Yeah.
Barbecue around 12:30 here.